people will observe them. Photograph taken by Nicholas van der Valle in Liège. Essentially, this is a droplet. The surface is moving up and down with time, and the droplet just bounces. And there's a very thin layer of air between the droplet and the surface, which can't escape due to its viscosity. These experiments have actually had some very surprising results, at the time, very surprising results, which have intrigued the world over the last 10 years. And they've measured various phenomena that are normally associated with quantum mechanical systems. And there's a growing body of papers about them. And here we're looking at providing a consistent explanation for these with not just an analog of things like the Schrödinger equation, but what I want to talk about more today is an experimental analog of the electromagnetic force as well, which will, as you'll see, intimately connected. Now, to give you a... Let's see if I can work this. Let's just start with an introduction about what it's all about.
The trail begins here with a drop of silicon. In his current laboratory, Eve Coudet and his team conduct an amazing series of experiments. They are observing the behavior of silicon droplets bouncing in lockstep on a vibrating plate.
The liquid of the drop never touches the liquid of the substrate. So they're always separated by an air film. And in fact, this is stable. You can keep the drop bouncing on the liquid surface for several days if you wish.
Using a camera that shoots 1,000 frames per second, Coudet has discovered that these droplets mimic behavior seen in the quantum world. And that shouldn't be possible, because the quantum world and the large-scale world play by two different sets of rules. Yet here we see a single droplet moving randomly like a quantum particle, but behaving like a quantum wave. If you watch this carefully, you'll notice that the wave appears to be guiding the droplet. In fact, the wave fields around the droplets develop a memory of the trails they have followed. Despite their random behavior, they follow a small number of paths. Again, this is eerily similar to the behavior of quantum objects. This runs so contrary to popular belief that at first, Coudet refused to believe what he was seeing.
In the inner physics experiments, you only see what you are prepared to see. Of course, this was very obvious that there was a memory, but it took us some time to realize that it was that we were observing, because you have to adapt to this new idea.
Perhaps most revealing of all, Coudet has reproduced the double-slit experiment using his bouncing silicon droplets. The mystery of quantum mechanics is, how can things like electrons sometimes behave like particles and sometimes behave like waves? Perhaps this is the answer. They are particles and waves. Of course, this system, though small, is not quantum.
Our system is not a model of quantum mechanics, but is an association of a particle and a wave, and some of its properties are similar to the properties that are observed in quantum mechanics.
Coudet won't claim that his experiments show us what is really happening down at the deepest layers of existence.
Okay. The rest of this talk won't be quite as entertaining. There'll actually be some equations and things. So, let's see. Let's start out reviewing the basic characteristics of the experiments, which have actually advanced since the very first experiments. So essentially, as we've said, the air can't squeeze out from underneath the droplet, which is why it's about. And of course, the air lubricates the horizontal motion. And so, from that point of view, the viscosity friction test for influence. In the original experiments, they didn't have this shallow region marked D here. And what would happen is, as you have a drop of balance, it would create waves, and these waves actually are excited further by the vertical oscillation, what's called a parabolic excitation. And you got an instability, the parallel instability, which is basically due to the fact that if you create waves and you turn them out and they reverberate, then very quickly the surface becomes unstable. And more recently, the purpose of adding these sorts of dips at the edge, what that does is it concentrates the flow so as to absorb the waves around here. And that actually suppresses this so-called parallel instability, which no longer occurs, at least in the latest experiments. And in fact, when we went out to see Nicholas van der Velde, he said he uses very low viscosity oils. And in fact, the problem with very low viscosity oils is the droplet evaporates. And you want to keep the mass of the droplet constant. But essentially, viscosity had relatively, even with the greater viscosity oils, actually, viscosity had relatively little effect on the phenomena to be observed. This is the bouncing motion. This is the picture you saw earlier. And you can see that the vertical surface executes one cycle here, and the droplet executes one cycle. But the phenomena of interest are at the double pivot. If you increase the vertical acceleration, then the droplet goes a little bit higher, and this is a numerical simulation with the maximum acceleration at this point being 3.5 g. So the surface is actually kept together by surface tension force. And this regime we'll be looking at. And I think the third thing worth looking at is what in other fields of study is called a band gap. And in this field of study, E. Coudet calls memory. A propagating wave is some of two standing waves, trigonometric identity. And the vertical motion, I won't go into the details, the vertical motion excites parametrically one component, and it de-excites, takes energy out of the other component. And so if you start out with a propagating wave, it will quickly become a standing wave. It also turns out that the vertical shading also reduces the group velocity of the wave, but I'm not going to talk about this here. So the speed, the characteristic speed C is actually smaller than you might measure from last distance. And the standard approach is to neglect these waves here. They do actually have an influence further away from the droplet, but they only influence the shape of the wave field rather than actually the motion of the droplet. Because these waves are very close to the droplet, which influence its motion. And they're given standard, almost everyone does this, they look at a Bessel function solution to the wave equation in this form, and they superpose different versions of this for various things. They think of the wave field as a superposition of these. And the big debate, John Bush takes this approach, and everyone else takes that approach. There's debates about how many, the details of it. Let's just have a look at one of these Bessel function waves. This is a droplet coming along, and here the droplet has died. What happens is it bumped into a bubble. But the waves continue for some time, 5 periods later and 15 periods later. And what has happened is the energy can't escape because of what is in semiconductor physics and other things, it's called a band gap. Here is the memory. And so these are the Bessel function solutions continue quite some time. They decay really quite slowly. Okay, that's a sort of review of the essential underlying physics. let's have a look at one of our discoveries, an inverse square force. In 2005, Susie Frottier and E. Coulet and so on produced this photograph, this stroboscopic photograph of a droplet moving around the edges of the container. And as you can see, reflected away from the edge of the pit. There's a position of the floor pushing it away from the edge of the container. And so I actually took this photograph and physically blew it up on a bit of paper and got a ruler and measured the distances. And from which you can infer, I plotted it in the wrong way, this is the square of the velocity, perpendicular velocity, all the velocity in this direction, perpendicular velocity, square of the velocity versus 1 over the radius. As you can see, near the boundary, straight line. And the straight line, the equation of that straight line is half mv squared is half mv naught squared minus k over r, which, as you might remember from your planetary physics, is the equation of motion for inverse square force. So the force is inverse square near the boundary. But there's a difference. And it's an instance is different. A reflection. The angle is different. You can see it's imagine it. And also the constant of proportionality in the force difference. These are the two phenomena we want to explain. And we ended up deriving them and found out it had been done before. In 1875, Carl Yerkes predicted an inverse square force between pulsating bubbles. He demonstrated it experimentally in 1880. Here's his apparatus. This was actually in Scientific American. What he did is he had a flywheel here and two pistons which he could either make go together, which would create big pressure waves, or like that, which created null this out. So he could control the magnitude of his pressure wave. These pressure waves made bubbles, which he had little bubbles inside of the bags, made bubbles pulsate. He measured there's an inverse square force. Essentially, what happened is now called the secondary Gerdner's force. If the bubbles pulsate like this, then they attract. And if they pulsate like this, then they repel. The secondary Gerdner's force is now used for degassing oil. Well, actually, it's used for demonstrations for people who show this sort of thing. For people who sell ultrasonic equipment. This is one with lots of bubbles in it, and you switch on the ultrasonic transducer. You just about see it. And what happens is the bubbles pulsate in phase one another, they attract and then emerge and you get rid of them. What's the origin of it? Well, these are two bubbles which are in the process of expanding. These are the flows, and as you can probably imagine by eye, on average the flow speed is greater on this control surface here than it is on this one here. And because there's a greater flow speed, there's a reduced pressure, reduced energy pressure, which gives you a force of traction. Now, in the case of the bouncing droplets, what happens is I've got a droplet bouncing here and it sends out and there's an image droplet in the boundary which is antiphase, which is why the force is one of the repulsion, an inverse square force of repulsion, which explains the experimental results we just plotted from the original data. See if we can understand it as a mathematics. The first slide is the one where you could probably do the mathematics in your head. The second one can be resolved. So, this is actually taken from papers on graduate textbook on the inverse square force between bubbles. You can call it the second Gerdner's force. So you imagine something, vacuum cleaner, ingesting air, probably Q1 per unit time. On a sphere of radius R, area 4 pi R squared, the flow speed is Q1 over 4 pi R squared. So this second one will ingest momentum in P by dt. It's got flow Q2 the density times the flow speed times that, which is basically an inverse square force proportional to the product of the strengths of the, in this case, vacuum cleaners. And you can imagine the centrifugal force is the average of this over a cycle. If you look at a resonant case of a resonant bubble, then you can imagine that the maximum speed tends to be, well, you can't go supersonic. So let's have a look at the case where the maximum speed of a resonant bubble with various populations is C. It turns out the centrifugal force can be written in this form. Alpha is a constant, I'll mention this constant which has a value which has a value about 1. Might be a tenth or might be 10, but B bar is this thing which M is the displaced mass of the bubble on average, C is the speed of sound, and omega is the angular frequency. And you can compare this to the force between electrons after H bar C over R squared. H bar is the mass constant, that produced constant, and alpha is 1/137. So this tells us something very interesting. It says that the centrifugal force is in the same, can be written in the same form as the force between two electrons, even with an analog of Planck-produced constant, which we'll come up against later. But the fine structure constant, which measures the strength of the force, is about 100 times larger than that for an electron. So this says that this is not a good model for the electron. It's merely an analog where the forms of the equation are the same. Actually, as it happens, these models are spherically symmetric. We'll come later to some cases where the motion isn't spherically symmetric and the value of alpha is reduced. That's the inverse square force of a secondary Vierkes force. Let's have a look at the walking motion. You saw that the droplet walks across the surface and has very little friction because it's always, because viscosity is involved in it, it's always on that. We got the original data, and energy for the original data, and this is the plot of the walker speed in millimeters per second against the maximum driving acceleration, you know, the vertical motion. And it increases. Let's see if we can understand the reason for this and understand it quantitatively. Well, there's two ways to calculate the field of a walker. There's the conventional approach, which I alluded to earlier. Mark Fleury, John Bush, Yves Coudet, and so on, all the places they take this approach. But they say P bounces like a standing vessel function, like those waves you saw in the earlier photograph. And that vessel function decays slowly due to absorption of the boundary. And so, I drop the bands here, and you start the vessel function here, and then it drops there, and you start another vessel function there, and so on. And you simulate it in a computer. And you get some pretty good results. There's another approach, which is to say, well, we can't afford a computer, even though we're in a computer lab, so we'll see if we can do it analytically. So, the Bessel function is just a function of x, y, and t, which obeys the wave equation. So, a good approximation. You might say there's dispersion, but the waves are non-chromatic, so there's no dispersion. The wave equation, as you probably know, the symmetric and the red transformation. This is something called an acoustic red transformation, which is actually the same as the transformation that's used in special relativity. In fact, this is a technique that is used for fluid systems and compressed fluids. If you're given one solution, f of x, y, t, you can always immediately write down another solution, f of x, y, y, t, right, where there are these transformations of coordinates. So, in this case, what happened is, given that this is a solution, this moving solution must also be a solution. But what's happened is it looks pretty much the same, except that it's susceptible to a direct contraction in that direction. In fact, this applies quite generally to anything on the surface of the moon. I've skipped over something. There's also the scale symmetry involved, which is a second order effect, which I'm not going to, the simplicity I'm going to skip over. The fact that the wave equation is symmetric under the Lorentz transformation is something that I think quantum mechanicists study in first. Okay.
What is the c?
C is the speed of the wave. It's not the speed of light. It's the speed of the wave. Actually, it's the speed of the standing wave. The parameter c of the standing wave
near the shallow water wave.
Yes, shallow waterways, which are actually modified by the parametric excitation to see if that should reduce. I can show you the dispersion equation is actually quite unusual.
It is actually the deep water canary oscillation.
Deep water, or is it that special depth where all the canary gravity waves are approximately non-dispersed?
It's okay. So, I knew this had come up, and I said, Ross.
I suggest we move on.
Yeah, why don't we move on? Essentially, it got complicated. In fact, the biggest perturbation is not due to the fact that it's capillary wave. The biggest perturbation is due to the vertical shaking of the thing, which has a big effect on the wave speed.
Surface tension is not important?
No, surface tension is very important. Yeah, it's dominated by surface tension, actually, apart from this vertical shaking as well. Gravity. Okay. Yeah.
The proximity to the
okay. As I said, in this field, they often talk about Faraday instability, which was important in the very first experiment, where there wasn't a region at the edge to absorb the energy. The instability that occurs here is not the same as the Faraday instability. It's something else. Which again. I think we probably don't have time to cover
that. That memory effect is tuned by the frequency.
Exactly. The memory effect is to do with the vertical oscillation, and it affects a lot of things.
Is everything at half the frequency of the driving oscillation?
That's right, yes.
So it's Faraday related.
It's Faraday related, yes. Right. Faraday's instability is to do with viscosity. So if you have very low viscosity, oil, it will occur at quite a small oscillation, but actually these you can use very low viscosity oil, so it's not actually the Faraday instability, but that's probably splitting some hairs. Okay.
I think focus on this, these all these experiments just the low criticality of Faraday.
They do often happen. You do run these things very close. Point where actually the wave speed becomes zero and the surface becomes unstable, but yes, that's right. Okay, so this is the simulation we saw earlier. If you have 3.5 G, what happens is if you increase the amplitude, then the drop will land later. Let's call that time t. Okay, and you can calculate t from this. And we've plotted the time t against the acoustic current factor. This is the original experimental data. And we found a very good match in the data that previously not been discovered. between the landing planetary and the ecliptic rotor factor, which all it does actually is it confirms that the wave equation is symmetric under the Rotor transformation. So it's no great surprise. But it says the droplet is moving according to this. Okay. So I think let's move on, because now we've established, I think this experimental data establishes that the surface is Lorentz covariant. So if I've got one solution to the equation of motion, I can always generate another by applying a Lorentz transformation, an acoustic Lorentz transformation. This gives us a predictive analog of the magnetic field. Wave equation is symmetric of the Lorentz transformation. Wave field has the same symmetry. So we predict that the inverse square set of the open spots also need to be symmetric under an acoustic Lorentz transformation. You might think, how do you calculate that? Of course, it's already been done for us. We can borrow a calculation from electromagnetism, where in undergraduate physics, you learn that if you have an inverse square force and you impose Lorentz symmetry, you get that sort of equations. And therefore, it seems that the force between the droplets, the inverse square secondary Biot's force between droplets, they Maxwell's equations. Now, there's one particular way we can test this. Let's have a look. That's two electrons, Coulomb force repel. Okay? If those two electrons are made to move parallel to one another with a velocity v, then you still got the Coulomb force, but there's a magnetic force. You imagine there's a and it turns out the magnetic force is E squared over C squared times the Coulomb force. So the total force produced by that factor. And you might remember the earlier experiments. What happens is you observe that when it's moving away from the boundary, due to the angle, it turns out it is moving faster parallel to the boundary. And there is a reduced and that is consistent with V being about 0.5C, which is sort of consistent with the experiments. Now, we think of this as at least an indication of a confirmation of an analog of the magnetic force amongst droplets. But of course, it'd be great to do some more experiments. So we've been trying to persuade some people to do some more experiments more quantitatively on this. In particular, here's an experiment you can do, which has been done qualitatively. I think you saw in the video, rotating droplet pairs. In this case, one is bouncing like that. And so the static force, if you imagine I've got a boundary here, image droplet, image pair over here. The static force is cancelled. But the magnetic light attraction remains. We predict it has a fine structure force of about 1/20, which means that the force will be about, it depends on those circumstances actually, but in this particular experiment, we predict it to be about 1/20 as strong as the force between individual an individual droplet will be trapped towards the boundary. Now, we went to Ecoude and said, "Well, have you ever seen this?" He said, "Well, actually, what we find is, if you don't actually just have a barrier, you have an area of reduced depth, which acts like a barrier that doesn't pull this extra weight and things. We found that these things were trapped, there's no fake hopscotch around it. So there's certainly experimental evidence. These things are attracted towards the boundary. It would be fantastic to get some experimental results and a measurement of the fine structure. I'm not sure I've got time to explain the mechanism. Very, very quickly, explain the mechanism. If you imagine this is rotating, you have to rotate in that way. There is actually a component of velocity here, which is like two equal and opposite forces. Again, the motions conspire together to the reduced manoeuvring force in between, which causes the attraction. Very rough idea, actually. It's not quite, not quite right, that, but it's a good way of showing people on further concepts. Okay, so much for the Maxwell's equations. Quantum mechanical behaviour. I'm going to only cover the essentials of this. Essentially, they measured single slip diffraction, which matched the single slip diffraction you see for quantum mechanical particles, double slip diffraction, tunneling. What they did is they got a region of reduced depth which repels the droplet. I measured the probability that it actually ended up crossing the barrier, and they found exactly the behavior we find in the cosmic. And they also have pen title bits with all the references. So, how can we explain that? There's rather a lot to explain, and there's not time to explain it at all. Let's describe it very, very briefly. You can factorize the field of a droplet. Again, we saw the photograph of that standing vessel function wave. Let's write it. The height of the surface is multi psi. Multiply by the second. Psi is r cos minus it to conform the convention constant. And I is the vessel function. So this is the time dependence, and that's the spatial dependence. If you now do a Lorentz transformation on this, then you end up with a moving solution. Magically, you find that psi is r cos minus omega naught t prime has a wavelength, which if you very, very quick, calculate the Rowley wavelength, number is 2 pi over k, is b over p, where b is the same analog of the Planck constant that we saw in the inverse square force, and p is the momentum wave. Well, once you've got something with a de Broglie wavelength, then, of course, most of the other quantum mechanical phenomena follow. Let me just illustrate this. I'm not going to go through all of the stuff. It can take too long. But, essentially, let's see if we can visualise this quantity psi in the droplets. Here's a photograph. Sorry, let me go back. Remember, psi is something like amplitude modulation, the wave field. And you see there's a wave field which is amplitude, if you can see it on the look here. So we see amplitude modulation. If you look here, that's zero on this line, and there's a zero on this line, and the phase, it goes anti-phase from here to there. So this thing, psi, is a way of actually picturing psi. Might be useful when explaining quantum mechanics to students who are new to quantum mechanics, that you can actually see what it looks like, at least in this analog. And you can actually, if you actually measure what the half wavelength, you say that's half wavelength, and the wavelength is about that, and it turned out that 30 degrees, which matches very nicely. And so there's interference between these waves of psi, which gives you the quantum mechanical diffraction pattern. Very briefly, something we've done regularly in quantum mechanics, I'm not sure it's away from this day. You have an equation, psi is r cos omega naught t, and you say, quantum mechanics, well, must obey this equation. That's the equation it does obey. And the motion has Lorentz symmetry, so this equation isn't symmetric from Lorentz transformation, so we need an equation that is Lorentz covariant, and this is the equation you start with. So we know about quantum. And this is called the Klein-Gordon equation for the wave function of quantum mechanical particle. And the Schrödinger equation for low velocity approximation to it, which I haven't got time to cover. Okay. Let's have a look at one further aspect, transverse waves in a fluid. We predicted that the centrifugal force of the inverse square force of the Maxwell's equation is an acoustic wave for C. And the experiment seemed to support this. Maxwell's equations have solutions in the form of polarized waves, polarized propagating waves, or light waves. Have you ever observed polarized waves in a fluid? What's the issue for it's possible? In 1957, Lev Landau predicted transverse waves in superfluid helium. And they've since been discovered experimentally, and actually there are several different mechanisms that are involved in transverse waves. Prior to 1957, many scientists thought them impossible in the fluid by models such as the one we've just described for quantum mechanics and for relativity and so on. Let's have a look at a simple model of transverse sound. Now, we haven't actually seen anyone produce this model, so it might be original, but we're still trying to find someone. Because in superfluids, they use very complicated mathematics, and I think things very simple. So this is a longitudinal wave. You know what it's like. It goes like that. And it propagates through a region of shear flow, and it acquires, as a result of that propagation, transverse components. But if you were sitting here, for example, you'd see this push over and then that gets pushed over. So this is a very simple mechanism for transverse sound in a fluid. And has it ever been observed? Well, there are photographs by Michael Berry in 1980 in water. Of course, this is limited to two dimensions, the two-dimensional surface of the fluid, so it hasn't quite got all limited in its polarization direction. But it's a pretty good idea. He observed water waves going past the vortex, which he called a bathtub vortex, and it literally was. He just got a tank of water and drained water out of the vortex. And of course, these waves induce flows in the plus minus x direction, which interact with the shear flows to produce a vertical components of motion. He thought that he described it actually as an analog of the Aharonov-Broglie effect, which is an effect to do with quantum mechanical particles interacting with the magnetic field. Very good analogy that happens. So, actually, the transverse components of a transverse wave in a fluid isn't the most obvious element. When the waves travel with the flow, and of course they travel faster than they travel against the flow, they travel slower. And so, as you can see, there are two waves above the vortex, and only one wave below it. It has the property that if you integrate the change of phase around the vortex, you get 2 pi. In fact, 2 n pi, they showed. They showed the properties. And he also showed, it's quite easy to show given the wave has angular momentum, but this thing has angular momentum. And of course, you can get the same phenomenon with less photogenic sound wave near a vortex. So, what happens? Let's just be very explicit about what we mean by a polarized propagating wave. See what happens if we modulate the amplitude of the wave in various experiments. Well, you probably know how radio modulation works, amplitude modulation. You can treat the amplitude modulation as an entity in external amplitude and magnetic components corresponding to amplitude phase modulation. And integrate a wave equation in its own right, a good approximation, as long as the frequency of the carrier wave is much greater than the frequency of the signal. And so the angular momentum, which is proportional to the amplitude of the wave, the angular momentum of the state vortex, will oscillate at the same frequency of the wave. And so the wave will behave like brackets could be confused with polarized propagating wave. Okay. Because the angular momentum of the direction perpendicular to the direction of flight. Let's have a look at some of the properties of a polarized wave in the fluid. Frequency is a property of the wave, just as it is the property of the signal in a radio transmission. And the wavelength is a property of the wave. But the polarization is a property of the pre-existing shear flows. Now, there's some famous experiments done, in 1969 and in 1972, in 1969, John Clouse and Michael Horn, up in the chimney, and Richard Holt produced something called the CHSH inequality, which has been a big conundrum in quantum mechanics. They assume the contrary for light waves. They assume explicitly that all properties, including the polarization of waves, are carried by the motorized within a photon. So, they move this X into here, in their assumption. And they found, when they measured it in 1972 and then our aspect measured it in 1982, it showed that this assumption is false. They generally believe they didn't make a mistake in their calculation. And so their initial assumption was false. And there are two ways to interpret this experiment of evidence. One way to interpret this experiment of evidence is that a photon is of the nature of the polarized wave we've just seen in the fluid. In the polarization, the correlation between the polarization of different positions is a measurement of the correlation between the pre existing shear flows, or the vortices, which in itself is a study. Which is quite straightforward. There's a second assumption. They also made a second assumption, which is that information can't travel faster than light. I made this on the basis that no one's ever observed information, any signals to be traveled faster than light. And so it's usually assumed in quantum mechanics that this must be the assumption that's wrong. And actually, there must be some process in quantum mechanics that causes information about the polarization to go faster than light, with some special little caveat that stops it. I think, at least it's worth considering, photons are of the nature of a polarized wave in a fluid. It's worth considering. Not proven. Okay, let's have a look at further work and conclusions. I haven't had time to talk about superfluid helium. Superfluid helium has similar structures called rotons. Superfluids, of course, have no viscosity, so there's no need for forcing acceleration. But the same mathematics applies, and so they will obey analog Maxwell and Schrödinger equation. And actually, this whole thing started when I went to Ross some time ago and said, well, I've got a fine structure constant of about a bit less than 150th for these things, and it's interesting. Since then, there have been some unexplained experiments later. Here's some absorption spectrum of the second hand to the third year. Very, very much fine absorption spectrum, and that's fine well being. This is really for further work. So to sum up conclusions, it's been an open problem the last 10 years, wide amounts in droplets behaved by quantum and particles. And we think we found an explanation based fundamentally on the fact that the wave equation is Lorentz covariant, and therefore droplets behave like particles in the real world, because like particles in the real world, they are Lorentz covariant. We found an experimental analog between electromagnetic interaction that obeys Maxwell's equations, and obviously, by positive analog Schrodinger's equation. I think there's further work. There are more experiments to be done in bouncing droplets to confirm some of this, particularly compensatively, particularly the magnetic interaction. And this might be of interest to people who want to have an analogy. So I asked the paper, email us for a draft, we've got a monograph on all of this, which we're still working on. We moved on for the last 3 years. So thank you very much.
So we have a mention of the hinge protocol. The first question is asked by a mentioned with your this second order unit it's not protocol for electrons. You have quantum mechanical things like quarks, but alpha is large. Do you know if anyone has looked at trying to do something like, say, where you get quarks performing in the
background state? Well, indeed. That's a very, very good question. Very, very good question. And there's, of course, you could look at the fluid mechanics of it all. You can look at the fluid mechanics of it. Of course, when you, things don't work when the particles and the droplets are very close together. In fact, as you saw in the video, they bounce in step and there are constant distance between them. And so they form into little crystals, which if you were able experimentally, it's very difficult to make them move. But if you could make them move, they suffer a contraction just by ordinary matter. But there's obviously some sort of short scale forces between them, and it'd be fascinating to look at. There's a huge amount of work to be done on that. I think we saw that the fine structure constant is about one in a spherically symmetric case. But actually, the other rotating case is much smaller.
Is there any way you're able to tune the parameters of the points? What sets alpha to one?
I haven't shown the calculation. You just do a calculation for a standing bubble, basically, with a surface scheme of the maximum C. And it's very approximate. But it's not 100.
What?
It's a footnote. It's time discussion. You've got to be totally confused about it when you brought out your two vacuum cleaners and said that the openness force is just like one of the vacuum cleaners swallowing fluid with and regurgitating it with a certain momentum. But the momentum in that picture is the momentum of an incompressible mass sinkhole source flow Q1. In other words, C is infinite in that argument. Sound speed is infinite.
This was a limitation of Bjerknes' experiments. In Bjerknes' experiments, he actually had done inside water, and the speed of sound water was very large.
That's my point.
So he wasn't able to measure. So he was able to measure the static forces, but he wasn't able to measure anything that we would think of as relativistic, where speeds are comparable to the speed of sound. But you're right. I've taken it for the case of compressible fluid, yes.
The electron formula you gave, I can't remember enough about quantum electrodynamics, but is that quantum electrodynamics counterpart of the ordinary Coulomb force?
This is the Coulomb force.
It is.
Just a way of writing it. It's not very complicated, it's just the Coulomb force.
It's the way it comes out of quantum electrodynamics.
Yep.
Because you've got the fine structure constant there.
Well, when you look at the Coulomb force, you need some constants to make the dimensions work.
Mm-hmm.
And the only ones you've got are A, B, and C.
So we usually, in our elementary way, think of Coulomb force. Awesome. One of the things you can understand if C is infinity. Yes, I mean, it's an electrostatic thing, but of course, if you want to relate to find such a structure constant, then you've got to deep, deep into the theory. But I'm still a little bit unsure when C comes in and when it doesn't in all these problems. By the way, in your bouncing top, C is actually the surface wave speed.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Using the word acoustic.
If there were an adjective meaning to do with the wave speed on the surface, it would be acoustic.
Well, the wave speed,
yeah.
You're right.
Perry, did you have a question? Oh, he's asked many questions.
Okay. So when you describe the bouncing droplet which guides the wave and the vice versa, it seems to go to the animal the pilot wave model.
Yes.
Now, so my question is, so far the attempts to construct a fluid pilot wave model for the interactive particle, which explains the specific relations of A. So how far does this now stretch?
Well, indeed. I mean, if you're going to calculate the motion of these droplets, you find that what Bohm did, he said, okay, if you know the initial, if you don't quite know the initial position of that part, he had a model that could basically describe the bouncing droplets. So he says, if you don't know precisely the initial position of the droplet, then you can calculate probabilistically what's the final position of the bouncing droplet. And in fact, if you borrow that calculation, then you find that you get the John Bush has done some fantastic experiments, very, very low noise, but he's able to prevent there from being any uncertainty in the initial position. And he finds that the quantum mechanical refraction disappears. And the particle is a very good confirmation of the Brodie Bohm model. But for two particles, the only thing we have is that there must be some correlations, like in the case of the propagating wave, there must be correlations between the particles and some other process. So yes, it's not another great area.
Unfortunately, I don't know
the
individual's name. I have to say, brilliant students and postdocs working with John Bush have done beautiful.
Yes.
John
Bush
is
very, very good,
actually. Yeah. So, what the vision that it is, of course, physical representation of the vision is there.
Yes, there is indeed an Aharonov-Bohm effect. If you want, there's.
Short.
Turns out. Get this wrong actually, but if you have a wave, let's call it the wave height, but actually I mean the density or something, 3 dimensions. H is R cos S. Okay, where R varies slowly and S is some function which is periodic in the sense that integral S by dt. Then you can have something called V sine dt of RS is equal to V, and essentially A is grad of RS, and they behave to all intents and purposes exactly like the vector potential of a magnetic, the potential of magnetic vector potential. And if you're interested in that, I'm happy to show you that in some detail.
It's just the only wave number and frequency, grad the wave number.
So, S is the phase, R is the amplitude. And we impose that the amplitude can only vary slowly over time. So the phase could be across a piece by 2 pi around the circle.
Okay, so when you take grad, the dominant term is grad S.
Yes, that's right.
Wave
yes.
Time,
right? Yes. Yes.
Good.
And the R is that, you could say R grad S, but it not matters. It needs this way.
See if I've got it right. If could A, discover the fact that all the droplets can be arranged in and can be manipulated in a variety of ways and discover the number of phenomena, am I right in thinking that your main insight has been the recognition of essentially special relativity, recognition that the Lorentz invariance of the of the phenomena.
Yes.
Hence, the analogy with all the other phenomena.
Yes, exactly. Essentially, I mean, he came here actually the Mathematics Institute.
That was the starting point for your.
My starting point was something prior to that, but yes, this was an example of it, yes. My starting point was actually two good things.
But it's the
yes, that's
key
right.
Difference between what you told us and what we heard from John Bush.
Yes, it's the symmetry.
Is that the Lorentz?
Yeah. If you've got an oscillation and a Lorentz, an oscillation plus Lorentz symmetry gives you quantum mechanics and the inverse square force plus Lorentz symmetry gives you maximum equations.
I'm trying to get my Lorentz transition. I've for many years taught undergraduate special relativity.
You know he's about to retire.
One of the foolish things I've said are that there's no such thing as ether frame staying with. Therefore, you need. Okay. In this case of droplets, there is a very privileged frame, the frame of water. And I describe it as being so sorry, describing that frame, I get very privileged. If I go to a moving frame that is less than the past, I get a different frame. My time frame is an effective.
The droplets do have a correspondence to the principle of relativity. In fact, any system that is arranged covariant has something that is slightly analogous to the principle of relativity. That is, we cannot determine in the case of droplets the velocity of the oil relative to the droplets by performing any intrinsic. This model was proposed by Lorentz in 1892. regarded matter as co-vibrating particles. But he thought that he made a mistake in saying that food cannot be a liquid. The medium can't be a fluid. And the reason was because at the time it was not known that there are transverse waves in a fluid. Thought they're impossible. Therefore, thought impossible to the whole light waves.
Yeah, after a myriad of questions that arose in relation to this very exciting talk, but there's just one element, isn't it? So, I mean, you throw out the analogue of Maxwell's equations, and immediately think of what is the analogue of the magnetic field, what's the analogue of the electric field? Your system is analogous to...
In the sense that they're the same equation, yes.
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 Right. The same equation must be an analogous variable.
Yes. One of the things...
I see the analog of the force there, but then there's more to it than the force that matches. There are the fields, the E and the B fields.
Yes, so...
What are the analogs of E and B?
Yes, well, B... I'm ascribed to B, and B is A.
Which would be B would be zero, which would be
grey white.
If you would think it's zero, then if you have a phase vortex, right, here's a phase vortex where you increase the phase by 2 pi, going around the centre, and put her out. There. B is not zero.
Yes.
At least when average, in fact, this is an approximation, you have to average.
Yes.
In fact, you say integral, the integral form.
I wanted to ask you exactly that slide. You're saying that polarization, but you need a shear flow in your body. You need the bath by the vortex.
Yeah.
So, presumably, the bath by the vortex is something that is in the ether, in the bath. You're saying the properties of polarization are because the vortex is there, not because of the wave. So what's the equivalent of polarized electromagnetic wave? Is that a vortex in the flow? So do we not work out the flow?
Okay. Let me just see if I can... essentially, you want to see where is this phase vortex, right? In the case of the droplet, is here. Here, the phase vortex. These two droplets going around each other are a phase vortex. In the center, you've got H is you've got a shear. Thank you. This is the, let's just say what?
Surface elevation.
This is h of the surface at the height of the surface. And in this case, there's a sum of terms. And the first term that's of interest to us is the Bessel function J1, which is of course only T minus E to J1 and R over C. And this is a phase vortex, which is a phase, T does not, the phase increases by 2 pi when we go around the center. It's like a phase vortex. There are actually similar structures that occur in supercooled helium.
A Harald Bohm type fluid experiment of varying. It's not just one phase jump to 2 pi and go around that vortex. But suppose I made the vortex a million times, well, even 10 times stronger. Surely I'd contract those waves quite a lot more and wrap them into a spiral. Would we still have exactly the same phase jump?
What he found is that there's actually a whole set of postgraphs which he has with a very small vortex and a large vortex and a large vortex. And the phase difference is always a multiple of 2 pi.
Or a multiple.
Always a multiple of 2 pi, and then you there's one 4 pi and 6 pi and so on. And he showed that actually reflected
motion. Let's just say the wave crest continuously, or they're not topologically broken. They're more crowded on one side than the other, that's what it's saying.
Some kind of disappearance.
Well, that's what I mean, outside. There's some alpha ring is in where it's called the things. Where hypothetical theory applies and you talk about the phase.
Last
question.
There is a dislocation. The dislocation happens here,
it's
where the phase is not defined.
Yes.
And in the case of the droplets, the dislocation happens at the center where the amplitude is zero.
You're losing the audio. But last question at the back. That's you.
Yes, right. I was just wondering, do you know if the people doing experiments on this have tried the analog results of the scattering experiment where you find two droplets what one of the close to the waves being through and see if you can get panic reaction? That seems to be the main new feature in relativism of quantum mechanics. That's not so.
Right.
Do you know if this is also?
There's a guy in Russia, Valery Spitnav, who has claimed to have been able to create droplet-anti-droplet pairs, that is, a droplet and a bubble. And how he does this is by firing two precisely tailored solitons at each other with the Muir bar. So we do have the beginnings of a toehold into proper quantum field theory.
My second question. There is an anti-droplet that's distinct from droplet.
For these purposes, it's a bubble.
Okay.
But that gets you only so far in two dimensions. In three dimensions, with rotons and liquid helium, it gets very much more interesting. Because normally, if you pull an ion through helium at, say, a millimeter per second, you get non-chiral rotons, which behave thermodynamically. But if you pull an ion through really, really fast, like a quarter of the speed of sound in the fluid, you get creation of pairs of rotons, so-called R-plus and R-minus rotons, and these then behave in very, very interesting ways with quantum evaporation happening at different distances. And so part of the future work that we're working on in our monograph is whether and to what extent we can extend analogs of quantum mechanics from two dimensions to three and account for experimental work in superfluids that so far doesn't have an explanation. If you're interested in that, send us email and we'll send you a copy of a draft of the monograph.
Thank you.
With that particular advert and a story of a Russian inventing anti-droplets, observing anti-droplets, I think it's a great place to end it. And thank Rob and Ross for a really interesting and incredibly thought-provoking talk to end off the year. And before we